Chapter 3. Enough imagination to keep his desk locked. His wife relished his style greatly. They were a childless couple, and Mrs. Rout, a big, high-bosomed, jolly woman of 40, shared with Mr. Rout's toothless and venerable mother a little cottage near Teddington. She would run over her correspondence at breakfast with lively eyes and scream out interesting passages in a joyous voice at the deaf old lady, prefacing each extract by the warning shout, "Solomon says." As he had the trick of firing off Solomon's utterances also upon strangers, astonishing them easily by the unfamiliar text and the unexpectedly jocular vein of these quotations. On the day the new curate called for the first time at the cottage, she found occasion to remark, as Solomon says, "The engineers that go down to the sea in ships behold the wonders of sailor nature," when a change in the visitor's countenance made her stop and stare. "Solomon. Oh. Mrs. Rout," stuttered the young man, very red in the face, "I must say. I don't. He's my husband," she announced in a great shout, throwing herself back in the chair. Perceiving the joke, she laughed immoderately with a handkerchief to her eyes, while he sat wearing a forced smile, and, from his inexperience of jolly women, fully persuaded that she must be deplorably insane. They were excellent friends afterwards, for, absolving her from irreverent intention, he came to think she was a very worthy person indeed, and he learned in time to receive without flinching other scraps of Solomon's wisdom. For my part, Solomon was reported by his wife to have said once, "Give me the dullest ass for a skipper before a rogue. There is a way to take a fool, but a rogue is smart and slippery." This was an airy generalization drawn from the particular case of Captain MacWhirr's honesty, which, in itself, had the heavy obviousness of a lump of clay. On the other hand, Mr. Jukes, unable to generalize, unmarried, and unengaged, was in the habit of opening his heart after another fashion to an old chum and former shipmate, actually serving as second officer on board an Atlantic liner. First of all, he would insist upon the advantages of the Eastern trade, hinting at its superiority to the Western Ocean service. He extolled the sky, the seas, the ships, and the easy life of the Far East. The Nanshan, he affirmed, was second to none as a sea boat. "We have no brass-bound uniforms, but then we are like brothers here," he wrote. "We all mess together, and live like fighting cocks. All the chaps of the black squad are as decent as they make that kind, and old Soul, the chief, is a dry stick. We are good friends. As to our old man, you could not find a quieter skipper. Sometimes you would think he hadn't sense enough to see anything wrong. And yet it isn't that. Can't be. He has been in command for a good few years now. He doesn't do anything actually foolish, and gets his ship along all right without worrying anybody. I believe he hasn't brains enough to enjoy kicking up a row. I don't take advantage of him. I would scorn it. Outside the routine of duty, he doesn't seem to understand more than half of what you tell him. We get a laugh out of this at times, but it is dull to be with a man like this in the long run. Old Soul says he hasn't much conversation. Conversation? Oh Lord! He never talks. The other day I had been yarning under the bridge with one of the engineers, and he must have heard us. When I came up to take my watch, he steps out of the chart room, and has a good look all round, peeps over at the sidelights, glances at the compass, squints upward at the stars. That's his regular performance. By and by he says, "Was that you talking just now in the port alleyway?" ... "Yes, sir." ... "With the third engineer?" "Yes, sir." He walks off to starboard, and sits under the dodger on a little camp stool of his, and for half an hour perhaps he makes no sound, except that I heard him sneeze once. Then after a while I hear him getting up over there, and he strolls across to port, where I was. "I can't understand what you can find to talk about," ... says he. 2 solid hours. I am not blaming you. I see people ashore at it all day long, and then in the evening they sit down and keep at it over the drinks. Must be saying the same things over and over again. I can't understand. Apostrophe, did you ever hear anything like that? And he was so patient about it. It made me quite sorry for him. But he is exasperating too, sometimes. Of course one would not do anything to vex him, even if it were worthwhile. But it isn't. He's so jolly innocent, that if you were to put your thumb to your nose, and wave your fingers at him, he would only wonder gravely to himself, what got into you. He told me once quite simply, that he found it very difficult to make out what made people always act so queerly. He's too dense to trouble about, and that's the truth. Thus wrote Mr. Jukes to his chum in the Western Ocean trade, out of the fullness of his heart, and the liveliness of his fancy. He had expressed his honest opinion. It was not worthwhile trying to impress a man of that sort. If the world had been full of such men, life would have probably appeared to Jukes an unentertaining and unprofitable business. He was not alone in his opinion. The sea itself, as if sharing Mr. Jukes' good-natured forbearance, had never put itself out to startle the silent man, who seldom looked up, and wandered innocently over the waters with the only visible purpose of getting food, raiment, and house room for three people ashore. Dirty weather he had known, of course. He had been made wet, uncomfortable, tired in the usual way, felt at the time and presently forgotten. So that upon the whole he had been justified in reporting fine weather at home. But he had never been given a glimpse of immeasurable strength, and of immoderate wrath, the wrath that passes exhausted, but never appeased the wrath and fury of the passionate sea. He knew it existed, as we know that crime and abominations exist. He had heard of it as a peaceable citizen in the town hears of battles, famines, and floods, and yet knows nothing of what these things mean though, indeed, he may have been mixed up in a street row, have gone without his dinner once, or been soaked to the skin in a shower. Captain McWhirr had sailed over the surface of the oceans as some men go skimming over the years of existence, to sink gently into a placid grave, ignorant of life to the last, without ever having been made to see all it may contain of perfidy, of violence, and of terror. There are on sea and land such men thus fortunate, or thus disdained by destiny, or by the sea. 2. Observing the steady fall of the barometer, Captain McWhirr thought, there's some dirty weather knocking about. This is precisely what he thought. He had had an experience of moderately dirty weather, the term dirty as applied to the weather implying only moderate discomfort to the seaman. Had he been informed by an indisputable authority that the end of the world was to be finally accomplished by a catastrophic disturbance of the atmosphere, he would have assimilated the information under the simple idea of dirty weather, and no other, because he had no experience of cataclysms, and belief does not necessarily imply comprehension. The wisdom of his county had pronounced by means of an act of parliament that before he could be considered as fit to take charge of a ship he should be able to answer certain simple questions on the subject of circular storms such as hurricanes, cyclones, typhoons, and apparently he had answered them, since he was now in command of the Nanshan in the China Seas during the season of typhoons. But if he had answered he remembered nothing of it. He was, however, conscious of being made uncomfortable by the clammy heat. He came out on the bridge, and found no relief to this oppression. The air seemed thick. He gasped like a fish, and began to believe himself greatly out of sorts. The Nanshan was plowing a vanishing furrow upon the circle of the sea, that had the surface and the shimmer of an undulating piece of gray silk. The sun, pale and without rays, poured down leaden heat in a strangely indecisive light, and the Chinamen were lying prostrate about the decks. Their bloodless, pinched, yellow faces were like the faces of bilious invalids. Captain McWhirr noticed two of them especially, stretched out on their backs below the bridge. As soon as they had closed their eyes they seemed dead. three others, however, were quarreling barbarously away forward, and one big fellow, half naked, with Herculean shoulders, was hanging limply over a winch. Another, sitting on the deck, his knees up and his head drooping sideways in a girlish attitude, was plaiting his pigtail with infinite languor depicted in his whole person, and in the very movement of his fingers. The smoke struggled with difficulty out of the funnel, and instead of streaming away spread itself out like an infernal sort of cloud, smelling of sulfur and raining soot all over the decks. "What the devil are you doing there, Mr. Jukes?" asked Captain McWhirr. This unusual form of address, though mumbled rather than spoken, caused the body of Mr. Jukes to start, as though it had been prodded under the fifth rib. He had had a low bench brought on the bridge, and sitting on it, with a length of rope curled about his feet, and a piece of canvas stretched over his knees, was pushing a sail needle vigorously. He looked up, and his surprise gave to his eyes an expression of innocence and candor. "I am only roping some of that new set of bags we made last trip for whipping up coals," he remonstrated, gently. "He shall want them for the next coaling, sir." "What became of the others?" "Why, worn out, of course, sir." Captain McWhirr, after glaring down irresolutely at his chief mate, disclosed the gloomy and cynical conviction that more than half of them had been lost overboard, if only the truth was known, and retired to the other end of the bridge. Jukes, exasperated by this unprovoked attack, broke the needle at the second stitch, and dropping his work got up, and cursed the heat in a violent undertone. The propeller thumped, the three Chinamen forward had given up squabbling very suddenly, and the one who had been plaiting his tail clasped his legs, and stared dejectedly over his knees. The lurid sunshine cast faint and sickly shadows. The swell ran higher and swifter every moment, and the ship lurched heavily in the smooth, deep hollows of the sea. "I wonder where that beastly swell comes from," said Jukes aloud, recovering himself after a stagger. "Northeast," grunted the literal McWhirr, from his side of the bridge. "Here's some dirty weather knocking about. Go and look at the glass." When Jukes came out of the chart room, the cast of his countenance had changed to thoughtfulness and concern. He caught hold of the bridge rail and stared ahead. The temperature in the engine room had gone up to 117 degrees. Irritated voices were ascending through the skylight, and through the fiddle of the stokehold in a harsh and resonant uproar, mingled with angry clangs and scrapes of metal, as if men with limbs of iron and throats of bronze had been quarreling down there. The second engineer was falling foul of the stokers for letting the steam go down. He was a man with arms like a blacksmith, and generally feared. But that afternoon the stokers were answering him back recklessly, and slammed the furnace, 23, doors with the fury of despair. Then the noise ceased suddenly, and the second engineer appeared, emerging out of the stokehold streaked with grime, and soaking wet like a chimney sweep coming out of a well. As soon as his head was clear of the fiddle he began to scold Jukes for not trimming properly the stokehold ventilators. And in answer Jukes made with his hands deprecatory soothing signs meaning : no wind can't be helped, you can see for yourself. But the other wouldn't hear reason. His teeth flashed angrily in his dirty face. He didn't mind, he said, the trouble of punching their blanked heads down there, blank his soul, but did the condemned sailors think you could keep steam up in the godforsaken boiler simply by knocking the blank stokers about? No, by George. You had to get some draft, to maybe everlastingly blanked for a swab-headed deckhand if you didn't. And the chief too, rampaging before the steam gauge and carrying on like a lunatic up and down the engine room ever since noon. What did Jukes think he was stuck up there for, if he couldn't get one of his decayed, good-for-nothing deck cripples to turn the ventilators to the wind? The relations of the engine room and the deck of the Nanshan were, as is known, of a brotherly nature. Therefore Jukes leaned over and begged the other in a restrained tone not to make a disgusting ass of himself. The skipper was on the other side of the bridge. But but the second declared mutinously that he didn't care a rap who was on the other side of the bridge, and Jukes, passing in a flash from lofty disapproval into a state of exultation, invited him in unflattering terms to come up and twist the beastly things to please himself, and catch such wind as a donkey of his sort could find. The second rushed up to the fray. He flung himself at the port ventilator, as though he meant to tear it out bodily, and toss it overboard. All he did was to move the cowl round a few inches, with an enormous expenditure of force, and seemed spent in the effort. He leaned against the back of the wheelhouse, and Jukes walked up to him. "Oh, heavens!" ejaculated the engineer in a feeble voice. He lifted his eyes to the sky, and then let his glassy stare descend to meet the horizon that, tilting up to an angle of 40 degrees, seemed to hang on a slant for a while and settled down slowly. "Evens. Phew. What's up, anyhow?" Jukes, straddling his long legs like a pair of compasses, put on an air of superiority. "You're going to catch it this time," he said. "The barometer is tumbling down like anything, Harry. And you trying to kick up that silly row." The word aerometer seemed to revive the second engineer's mad animosity. Collecting afresh all his energies, he directed Jukes in a low and brutal tone to shove the unmentionable instrument down his gory throat. Who cared for his crimson barometer? It was the steam, that was going down, and what between the fireman going faint and the chief going silly, it was worse than a dog's life for him. He didn't care a tinker's curse how soon the whole show was blown out of the water. He seemed on the point of having a cry, but after regaining his breath he muttered darkly, "I'll faint them," and dashed off. He stopped upon the fiddle long enough to shake his fist at the unnatural daylight, and dropped into the dark hole with a whoop. When Jukes turned, his eyes fell upon the rounded back and the big red ears of Captain McWhirr, who had come across. He did not look at his chief officer, but said at once, "That's a very violent man, that second engineer." "Jolly good second, anyhow," grunted Jukes. "Hey, can't keep up steam," he added, rapidly, and made a grab at the rail against the coming lurch. Captain McWhirr, unprepared, took a run, and brought himself up with a jerk by an awning stanchion. "A profane man," he said, obstinately. "If this goes on, I'll have to get rid of him the first chance." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.